25 years of Vampire the Masquerade presents Vampire the Requiem.
Welcome, everyone, back to 25 years Vampire the Masquerade retrospective podcast, where today we're actually covering Vampire the Requiem Nomads. We are your hosts for today, Chris, and my co-host, Brennan.
Hey, Chris. Good to be on here again with you.
We caught him off guard, folks, because you might be wondering, where is Bob? Well, Bob isn't with us today as he's method acting, being a nomad, traveling about and actually taking care of business. So if folks want to know exactly what it is that Bob is doing, please feel free to ask us on the Discord. I'm sure he'll have many tales to regale you with. But getting back to business here, this is an interesting book, folks, because once again, we are running into, well, why would you put out a book regarding nomads to begin with, right? Why coteries and nomads so soon after the core release of first edition Requiem? And I'd like to say off the bat that it's one of those things that doesn't really get talked about as often. Sure, we have in Masquerade a couple of stories about vampires that go on their own and try to move out of a city. For what purposes? Unsure, but we always know there's a tale to kind of be exacted with it. However, this book kind of goes over the reasons why, especially different type of covenant members, as well as clan mates, would want to go ahead and make that happen. To kind of kick it off, I guess we could begin with our prelude story. Brendan, would you be able to kind of give us an overview of what happens here?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So the prelude story starts with, it starts listing out the members of a traveling band, which is this coterie, right? There's the front woman who is kindred. There's the lead guitarist, who's also another kindred. And then there is the manager, quote unquote, who is also a kindred. And those are, at face value, the only people there. Now, I say people, right? But that's from a vampire standpoint. You don't see ghouls as people. And they certainly have two or three there as well, just describing how they travel from city to city, lining up gigs. I also, from the initial narrator standpoint, it doesn't seem they're unbound. They're not members of any covenant, right? And as the story progresses, it shifts around to different people's perspective, where some people in the band are seeing things that others aren't. Like the manager, every time they come into a city, he always tries to keep them away from the other vampires that occasionally might show up or quickly get them out of a city. But it seems like he's up to something, right? He's always going to meet with people. He's always doing something and then not letting them know what he's doing. Like, is he working for someone? And that reaches ahead when the band, as they're traveling from city to city, gets run off the road. Van is totaled. The light proof boxes that they all shove themselves into every day, those are smashed and currently burning in a van. And people, this is where tensions start riding high, right? Lead guitarist I mentioned before, who, he was always described as having a little bit of an ego, and he's the one that starts tearing the group apart like you'd expect in any...
the prima donna of the group. He's already starting to make tensions rise there.
And that's when it's... I'm not going to spoil the whole story because I liked the twist that's there, but they have to make some tough calls. Like, all right, they can't get to the city before dawn, because it's just like 30 minutes away. So what are we going to do? So they end up showcasing some nomad ingenuity that you have to survive, where they get the ghouls. At least the plan at face value is to get the ghouls to stake them and then bury them and come back when they have a ride. Because if they're staked, they're not going to spend blood. They can't just walk to the next place. So when times are tough, you got to take extreme measures. Another thing I liked about that is they didn't tell you if it worked or not.
They don't. But you know what? That's pretty, I gotta say, like, even reading it, I thought that it was like, all right, basic story as we're going through. It's one of the stories, like a slice of life, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. And it isn't until they go like, well, we're going to have to stake you. Like, wait, what? Yeah. If we do this, you're going to last a little bit longer. And we don't know when we're going to get back. So for two reasons, you also assume that the reason you also stake them is because you don't want them frenzying, especially when they get dug back up.
Right.
So, you know, as a preventative measure, I was like, nice. Well, thinking ahead, kudos to you. But yeah, it really doesn't tell you whether or not they survive. But I think that's the point, right? It's mm-hmm. one of those risks that you take having left a city, the comfort of a city, knowing that you have that cage around you. You know, and that gives us a nice segue into the, you know, the next thing that we definitely want to hit upon, which is why become a nomad at all, right? Why move away from the city, especially when you know that the city provides you everything you need? In this Danse Macabre, how do you move away from those that are going to be interacting with you and give you, you know, a reason to exist, right? One of the things that we covered here, we definitely want to bring to attention, is that freedom relinquished to live there. You don't have to be there in order to actually exist. And even more so than that, there will be individuals that do kind of wake up and snap from that ideal and take others with them. I think there's a quote here. Brennan, would you be able to tell us, you know, what your thoughts are on that?
Yes. The quote is, every city is a cage, a prison, a madhouse ruled by monsters. But in each one, the door to that cage is always open. Now, I remember a couple of weeks ago now, when we were reviewing the core book, there was when it was talking about the vampire society in a city, it described the city as a gilded cage. They might be in control, but it is still something that they are caged in, and they're locked in with other monsters. That is something that is, I love that description because it's perfect. They are trapped in here with other monsters, and they're trying to crawl over each other to reach the top. But what happens when you when you get kicked down as you're climbing up, or maybe you reach the top and you don't you realize this is it's still a cage? Is the freedom worth all that stuff that you work to get, like sacrificing it? And to some people, it is.
And it's interesting you should mention that, because being in that cage is a willful act. You mm-hmm. choose to be in there. You decided these are going to be your inmates in this prison that you're occupying. So then, you know, why then would you ever want to leave a city? And as you mentioned, there might just be that moment where you've had enough. Maybe the city isn't producing. The hierarchy is not working out in your favor. Maybe you're being exiled as is. Your covenant is on the outs and you got to get out. Perhaps you've caused more than enough trouble, and it's time for you to go, because you know the only other option is either going to end up with your destruction and or you being staked and no one remembering where you were buried underneath that Chuck E. Cheese, right? That's like one of the worst things ever. And then you have to worry about those kids and machine going back and forth and like that awful pizza. Sorry to those folks that like Chuck E. Cheese pizza. I'm not that much of a fan. However, you kind of get the grip there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I do. I certainly do.
It definitely is. And, you know, one of the other things that we wanted to kind of go over is, you know, what situation would you find yourself even wanting to either do it alone or go with a group?
Oh, that's a couple of questions. It could be like you're not given a choice, right? Like you talked about before, it might be you're in between, like you either got to see the sun or you got to see the road. But I can also think of a couple of situations where you might go alone, and that maybe the reason you're leaving is to come back later. Like you have a job from the prince or from a covenant where you have to travel to a neighboring city and talk with someone, deliver something like that. Maybe it doesn't warrant more people, or maybe it's so secretive that it has to be only you. I'll be honest. I think this is by and large the least chosen option out of between the two, right? Because there's only two. What are you going to do? You're either going with someone or you're not. Because vampires are inherently social creatures. Those coteries, like we've talked about in the mm-hmm. previous book and in the core book, coteries come together for a purpose and break apart later, because you can't sustain relationships as a paranoid, you know, blood-eating monster. But you also crave that connection, or you start losing yourself. And so it's a horrible balance. But and I think because of that, few people would ever go alone if they had a choice.
If they had a choice, right? Because you could see how this kind of works into the favor of, well, what if you're a traveling band, so to speak? You start off in one city, you're lucky enough to even to make it to the other. Mm-hmm. And this is under the assumption that you're the only one kind of going it alone, the first city or town that you kind of skip versus creating it there. The book does a really good job of this, because as you notice, there's a pause there between us as we start thinking about it. Yes, of course, there's information regarding how the Nomad book covers it. But more importantly, you as the player, and especially one who's used to staying within the city, right? And if you're planning on running a campaign outside where you're transients, where you want to play, you want to play a vampire just on mean streets, onto the road, into the highway, where your cuts on your motorcycles. But what now? What are the things that you would or would not encounter? You know, romantically, it's something that crosses your mind. But in effect, there's always that moment of, oh shit, really, is this what I wanted to do? Mm-hmm. And bringing that up, this, you know, this book kind of does go over why certain clans would hit the road. And if they do hit the road, specifically what roles they kind of would take. Like for the Deva, you might have someone who might act as the bait. You know, as alluring as they are, they're the ones that are probably going to provide you meals for your coterie there. Mm-hmm. Your Ventru might be taking a look at be the front man to kind of be the one to negotiate and or the face. But one of the ones that caught our attention definitely was Nosferatu, specifically the Harrowing. Would you be able to tell us about that, Brent?
Yeah, so the Harrowing is a all Nosferatu. Well, first off, it's named off of a specific coterie who called themselves the Harrowers. They were, like DJ just said, all Nosferatu coterie, but they fully embraced their monstrous appearance and the reputation of their clan. They would go about and, if memory serves right, they were the ones that would go around, start terrorizing like small towns or neighborhoods. And then they would begin, after doing this for a while, they'd leave a message out for someone to, basically that sacrifices were required, and they would make them send out people to be devoured, or they would, and then they'd go on to the next location to, keep this like roving urban legend alive.
And why do you, I mean, that's pretty interesting, because now it plays to the Kindred's ego, right? At this mm-hmm. point, they're just doing it for straight A, shock value, and B, it's almost as if scouting using legends, right? To push that forward, because now you know the next town might end up hearing about this and or it's going to end up on the news somewhere. And it's that push your luck situation where you're like, if they hear about it, someone might be looking for us. But at the same token, is it really Kindred? Could it be something else supernatural? Is it a boogeyman situation? But once you hit that town, now you're kind of building up to it, which I think is very, very, very clever. They know that they can't stay there too long. You know, someone's going to start investigating at some point or another. But if you keep that myth going, you know, how awesome is that to kind of have that in the background?
Yeah, it's crazy. And if you I think if that myth is self-perpetuating enough, it's just easier to feed as you go along, right? Because that legend brings people up like Actually, now that I think about it, I would love to run a coterie that like impersonates local urban legends, like someone trying to be that hooked man that finds people on Lovers Makeout, or that gangrel that pretends to be what was it, Mothman in Virginia?
Yep,
that's actually pretty good.
It is. I mean, that definitely would provide like an entertaining angle, and it almost seems like a competition. Our minds are running, folks. You can mm-hmm. only imagine saying like, create a coterie out of people who just try to outdo each other, almost like a Carney act, but at the same token, like whose myth is better at this point? But yeah, that's one of the examples that you would see reading, like of why certain specific clans would either get together or a member of a clan and what they would serve, especially on the road. Although you might ask yourself then, what about covenants? Specifically speaking, when you take a look at covenants in general, we've already once again determined that being within the Gilded Age of a city, your covenant could grow or diminish accordingly. That's where your power primarily is. That being the case, though, as you are on the road, why take other members of your covenant with you? What type of power do you think these covenants kind of hold? And in this, we're not going to go over every single one. There's a very huge plethora of reasons why each covenant would take the road itself. But we kind of chose a couple, you know, one a piece that we thought stood out the most to us. And I think we'll start off with the Carthians. Mm-hmm. Brendan, you chose this one, the Champions. Tell me about that.
I did. So the Champions kind of struck me sideways a bit, right? The Carthia movement is all about upsetting the status quo, right? So whenever a movement in a city takes over, a champion coterie is not from that newly established city. They're from somewhere else. Maybe it was a neighboring domain that was like assisting them or directing them. But the Champions, in my mind, I thought they would be like people that would come in to try to like lead or coordinate this war effort. But no, they come in after the fact, after the battle's already been won, to basically tell the Carthians who just fought for the Carthian movement what the movement's all about. Right. That's why they're called champions, because they champion the ideals. Now, I can see where that would be needed. Right. If you have some like political movement, or if you're reorganizing someone always needs to lead that charge. But I just couldn't help but think, if I'm that young Carthian neonate that just was part of a collective that beat the crap out of the prince and dragged him into the sun. Now, all of a sudden, these five jerkwads from the next city over are here telling us how what we should be doing. In my mind, they'd be up next to view the sun. You know what I mean?
No, definitely. But then you have to wonder, if that's the case, where do the champions find success? That's the better question. Because if they're already picking on, like, all right, good job there, little brother. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you how it really works out. All right, so if what you really want to do is, so from your perspective, Bren, like, where would they succeed?
Where they would succeed is, as much as I said, I would hate seeing them as like a character. They, I do think more experienced members of a movement or any organization that are more experienced than others, them passing down that wisdom or actual instruction, that is always priceless. That can always help. I think that reason I've stated to begin with is why they're described as they don't stay in any city for long. They're constantly moving. So that is where they win, DJ, because they spread those lessons around or those ideals wherever they go.
I think that they're huge moochers. It's like, oh, well, there's this party. They're the people who, like, you know, that party's being thrown with your buds. And at one point or another, the unspoken rule is everyone brings some sort of alcohol to the party, right? Mm-hmm. You bring a beer, you bring a bottle of Jack, whatever the case is. And then all of a sudden, you have this group that just walks in and goes like, what up? And they walk straight to the fridge, start drinking your stuff. And they're like, you know what? It's time for me to go. Sorry, folks, got work in the morning. They're like, but no one even invited you in the first place. And before you know it, all your resources depleted, right? You're not even sure who invited them in the first place. And off they go. And I think they're just like the ultimate moochers. But it works, folks, right? And it's interesting to see that into effect, because that shows you how you could use the guise of your covenant to kind of get to your own ends. Mm-hmm. And who better than the Carthians to be able to kind of mess around with the perception of, hey, you did the right thing by toppling this, but here's where you could have done better. Let me show you. You know what it reminds me of as well, Bren?
What's that?
Oh, man. What's the name of that movie? The cheerleader movie. And then there was that dude who came around with the spirit fingers and he kept on peddling the spirit fingers thing to every other.
What are you talking about?
It's another movie. For those of you who have seen it, they completely understand. All I'm going to say is spirit fingers. You'll know it when you see it. But moving on ahead, before I see Bren's mind just explode here, we'll talk about the circles of the crone. And the circle of the crone is pretty interesting because what I like about this is that we're going to be speaking about the seekers in darkness.
Mm-hmm.
But what draws my attention particularly is, like, it mentions that when you're a member of the circle of the crone, a lot of what you're doing is pushing your own self-experience to gain wisdom from it. You push to the extreme in order for you to know that new nugget of information to be able to move with it. However, wisdom does not equal knowledge. And that is a huge difference, right? So whereas you're continuously going through these particular rituals to glean some sort of epiphany or better understanding of yourself, you're eventually going to run out of material for you to be able to practice with. And I think this is where this coterie comes into effect.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. Like you were saying, these while they might gain like wisdom about themselves, like what do they know about the world or darkness in general? And once you've been in a city in one of these cages for long, how much more can you really grow, right? Because that is the point of their tribulations for the circle of the mm-hmm. crone. It is through effort that they grow. It's the same thing with, like, every time I read that, I think me going to the gym and like focusing on like upping my bench press for the next week, right? If they've pumped everything in one city, they got to go to another city, or maybe even worse for a vampire, they got to go into like some rural, like nowhere to really push themselves even more. And I love this coterie concept a lot. Like when I remember first reading it, I chuckled to myself because, like, these guys seem like the jackass group of kindred, right? But the more I think about it, the more they are what they actually are kindred that are dedicated to, and I say this, it's almost like the Ordo, they're dedicated to improving themselves by like pushing past their limits, but they're not focusing. They're focusing on how the curse makes them stronger, right? And yep. So they go out and seek these new challenges, always growing. And I love that mentality, I'll be honest. So that always sings to me. And that's why this coterie is like, it's got a special place in my heart out of all the ones here in this book.
Another thing to kind of mention alongside that is crones aren't, you know, these acolytes aren't used to kind of going in groups. They don't really ask anyone to leave a city. And the reason why is because everyone's journey is their own. That's the biggest thing about the Acolytes, is everyone's journey is their own. You'll reach enlightenment in whichever fashion you feels best for you. So to even get everyone along on the same page to be like, you know what, this is what we're going to do, is automatically, to me, as I view it in my head, seems like a great chronicle to start, because you could see where the inherent conflict also ends up going when someone does find that nugget. Is it yours? Is it ours? Did we agree it was ours? And if it is, how much of this knowledge are we able to spread evenly, if such is the case?
Mm-hmm.
But we're also on the road, so it's not like we have an established home. We're done with this location, but where are we going to stay next? So I agree with you, Brent, in that particular regard. But I think the nuance of it is what caught my mind.
I gotcha. And I agree with that, now that you point that out.
Speaking of nuances as well, for the Invictus, the Persevants are the ones that took our attention. Now, the weird part about this is, why leave the city at all if you are Invictus? You mm-hmm. are dynasties upon dynasties. You are there to go ahead and monitor things, as it's written in first edition. You work with the mortals mm-hmm. to such a degree that your power lies on them. And you say, but isn't that, they do follow that do as I say, not as I do mentality. And so in this particular case, when you take a look at the Invictus, a lot of it is almost lockstep. It's almost every single nomad coterie or traveling coterie here serves a particular purpose. And one of them that drew us once again was the Persevants. And their whole purpose is to play the role messenger.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see inklings of things that you'll eventually end up seeing in V5 and definitely from the perspective of elders, which is you can't trust technology, right? Anything could be manipulated. Text messages, emails, even communique in the form of like written media might be something that could be compromised at one point or another. So what do? They send a messenger or band of messengers
mm-hmm.
To verbally, you know, communicate this information. And what I find awesome about this is that message could literally be just one messenger themselves, or it could be an entire coterie of them. And each member is given a specific line to deliver, so that if one of them gets captured, you don't get the entire message. You only get a fraction of it. And or how do you not know that this coterie may or may not have gotten dominated or through the use of specific types of disciplines, manipulated to be able to just kind of create their own type of puzzle so that the recipient of this message is able to hear it? That is, I thought that was pretty funny, because we always hear the story of a messenger, right? One of the things that one of the more common things that we see across all the covenants here that we didn't want to cover, because it just, you know, spy is the most common one. A spy.
Yeah, everyone has a spy. Everyone needs a spy.
Everyone has a spy. Everyone has an assassin.
Right, yep. Exactly.
So we didn't want to cover those. and this is the reason, you know, for the Invictus, this is pretty cool to have that. Because another thing that comes along with it is, Persevants are known. You can't just walk into a city and start harassing them, because they are there under the auspice of the person who sent them to deliver a message. So they're technically shouldn't be, you know, touched. They should be untouchable, so to speak. But that might not always be the case. But you could start seeing where an important message has to be delivered from one domain to another. And you better hope that these folks make it through. And I think that's where the fun starts, right?
Mm-hmm.
To see whether or not they actually do get to deliver the message, and or if the message is cryptic enough that particular coterie delivering the message is pretty much kill orders. Each one of them says, you know, you should eliminate this person. You should eliminate this person. You should eliminate this person. That's another fun game to play there. Brent, any thoughts on the Invictus and the Persevants in terms of how they're enacted?
I loved just how complicated the extreme steps like Invictus elders would take just to send messages to people, because they don't. You and I both know exactly what you said, right? Technology can't be trusted because it can be intercepted. However, there is also another type of nomad coterie for the Invictus and I'm only mentioning it because it's important for this analogy. It's they exist solely to educate elders on current events, current technology. And I just can't help but think, I'm pretty sure elders use this just so they don't have to learn how to send an encrypted email.
You're right. You know what it also reminds me of? If I was playing like really, really devious with folks, I think of the movie Trading Places, and you think of the brothers Mortimer and Randolph, and how they just had the bet for a dollar. Your domain has crumbled. And you send the one guy, he doesn't even know why, and he's like, Lord Mortimer, yes, the dollar. that son of a bitch, right? I can see where it's funny that way, but yes, you are completely correct in that. The other thing we want to, the other covenant next up on our list is definitely the Linkea, right? What did the Linkea have to offer? Now, folks, you know, the typical thing is, and Brendan and I took a look at this, we're like, all right, most common thing that we would think of even before looking at it from a kindred perspective are missionaries, right? Missionaries, evangelists, people that are going to spread the good word of longinus to everyone else. But there's other things that also kind of work along with it, too. That's just a common one, you know, and that's what they also want you to believe. Misdirection is everything. Perception is everything. But the one that kind of tickled our fancy here was definitely a warrior coterie. What is a warrior coterie? Now, it's not as obvious as you think it is. Brent, do you want to take a stab at it first? And
yeah, so when I first read warrior coterie, I was like, yes, this is the Crusaders. These are the people that go out in war against, you know, the heretical Circle of the Crone, right? That's true. Those individuals would be warriors. But that's not all of it. The Linkea does preach a message that everyone was embraced for a reason, right? And they're typically anti-final death, right? Our good friend and fan favorite, Solomon Birch is a big proponent of that. But every so often, there's that one loudmouth that every bishop just looks at and thinks, I need to shut him up. That is when these warrior coteries are assembled, or would be a reason, right? However, because of that, sometimes you need some plausible deniability. You might call them in from outside of the city, or maybe, thankfully, these rivals fled in exile. Maybe you made a show of gracefully allowing them to leave for their lives, and then you kind of just like give the motion. You guys can't see this because you know this is a podcast, but I'm doing that thing with my hands where I'm like back behind me. I'm like motioning for people to like move on.
Yes. One day, folks, we promise you'll see us. You'll see an image of us and it'll be great for you to participate. But Brent's right. You know, you have plausible deniability. You have the ability of folks that are probably on the mend with the potential of coming back. Chances are they probably won't, though. But you do this because you don't want to. This is the pettiness of that, which is being a kindred, especially amongst a gilded cages. Mm-hmm. You don't want them to point fingers at you because you know exactly how that's going to turn out. You can't use your own assets because, you know, eventually the breadcrumb trail is going to lead directly to you. These warrior coteries are created specifically for that purpose. Yes, Brother Dumas, please come into the city. We have spoken to your bishop. We'll, pay when the time is due. Of course. And your trouble goes away. So that was another interesting coterie members, or rather coterie group, so to speak, that we found. And lastly, the Ordo. Mm-hmm. And for the Order, we're talking about the journeyman. And I know you're passionate about this one, Brent. Hit us up with that.
Yeah, I love these because these, in my mind, this is the this is what the Order is all about. Now, as you what are a journeyman? The title refers back to like old craft guilds, right? Because you would have your apprentice. That's what people start out with. Then you have your journeyman, and then you have your masters. A journeyman is like what the name sounds, right? And obviously it is because this is the Nomad's Book. This is one that goes out and journeys with the intent of going out and learning as they go, learning new things that maybe their master didn't know, whoever taught them, or new techniques that are out there. And likewise with the Ordo, who are a secret society of scholars, they are going out and learning about the different ways to grow or defy the curse or what else is out there. Of particular interest to the journeymen are the what they call the dragon lines. And I always equated these with like ley lines, right? I think honestly they're pretty much the same thing, just the Ordo Dracul flair. And they try to map out these dragon lines and where they converge and make dragon nests. And they'll go throughout all, it's generally a specified region. They're not like random journeyers. It's just within a typically an area they're aware of, and they'll go to different chapter houses. And they'll study if whatever they're allowed to study, right? And trade information as a journeyman is expected to do. But with this, I love this idea because I'm just like going through my head of someone going from city to city and investigating the darkest, most urban legends, or like the secret horrors that make the even regular kindred, like, you know, flee.
And it's true. And I think this is one of the ones where we see a small break in terms of what our concept of nomad is, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just being on the road. They're more like cartographers than anything else, right? They're scouting a city. It could just be the neighboring city itself or the neighboring town. They'll eventually come back, you know, to deliver their messages. But chances are that unless they do very well, they'll probably be back to studying and that's it for them. You know, only the best of them are probably going to be given another pursuit for them to follow. So that's that definitely brings to attention what works out there, you know, which then leads us over into like archetypes. You say to yourself, great, we know from a perspective, we have these covenants. We know what would kind of drive them to go ahead and be on the road. But then what type of character would actually end up on the road themselves? You know, and to that, this book does an amazing job of at least from my perspective, now looking at it from first edition eyes and as it was brought out, you know, one of the things that this book does do is it gives players character archetypes, and it also helps build on specific things. It mm-hmm. gives you mechanics of like why you would build this character. What types of disciplines would you probably aim for, especially being on the road? And what is your calling? What is the ambition that you were kind of hoping to achieve? And it gives you that in spades. If anything at all, I would highly suggest this is probably one of the true nuggets of value here, the gems that you probably haven't seen in other books up until this moment in time when it was written. That definitely drew my attention there.
Yeah, to just hammer home what you're saying, I really enjoyed this section of archetypes because it occurred to me these are basically templates, but more generalized, right? And yes. that allows you to more easily put your own personal spin on it, because you and I think you and I both played in games plenty enough. Like maybe one of your friends is putting together like a game and you're like, what do I want to play? So you look at options. I typically will look through like if it's a Masquerade game, I'll flip open some of the old clan books and look at the templates just to see, are any of these interesting to me, or do I want to riff off this idea? And going at archetypes, my only regret about this is I wish this was in more books that were published, because this was really good, but all of them focused on like the nomad experience, which maybe they need to for this, but I don't know. I found this incredibly fun to read and full of ideas.
Who knows? Somewhere out there, someone out there mm-hmm. will listen to us and be like, got it. Take this section of nomads, add it to another product. Mm-hmm. Well, we can only hope, right? but definitely, this definitely drew our attention and we loved it. We spent some time in here as well, if only because we could get into debates about, is this the right discipline? Is this not the right discipline? Though, to be honest, folks, we know that originally, I'll hammer this part before we move on to our next section. It's like, we think in Cambro, usually, right? If we're going to be on the road, don't we want some fortitude? Don't we need some protean? We need something to stay alive, maybe some celerity, run from the sun into a building, etc. But such is not always the case. You know, your character, as we mentioned in many, many podcasts, is based on you. The flavor that's given to them is the most important thing, and why they would take these disciplines mean everything. And especially when you're looking at it, maybe Auspics for a mecha to take is more important in a particular section. However, if that's not the lifestyle that you want to choose, and just because it's a signature discipline, doesn't probably fit in it. You're probably going to be taking a look more at Obfuscate and Celerity just to keep yourself alive, and especially considering you might have some enemies. All that is covered in the book. Now, the better question is, why would you have to hide nomads and traditions? I think this was really cool for a couple of reasons. Who follows them and why? And to kind of preface that, the book mentions this one line in there where it says that the first three traditions that are brought up that we've mentioned in our core book before don't lend themselves to protecting elders.
Not at all.
Right. So when we take a look at like Dark Ages, Vampire Dark Ages from the V20 line or the 20th anniversary line, and even, you know, Masquerade 20th. When you take a look at the way that the traditions are kind of structured, they lend themselves to that. The status quo will always be there, but it's always to keep that one powerful elder in check, right? To make sure that they keep what they have. Not so much here. And because of it, there's a lot more flexibility as to why nomad coteries would want to follow or not follow traditions. And I think the ones that they normally espouse are enforce them because no one else would. Mm-hmm. Your vigilante type. Brent, can you think of like a vigilante type that would definitely be like roaming about, bring justice across land, if anything?
Can I think of one? DJ, this is Vampire Mad Max.
It is.
That's what it
actually
is.
Actually, yeah.
I love the idea of like a road traveling like knight errant who doesn't, or I guess like Ronin, or you know what I mean? Someone who doesn't answer to someone, but just does what they do because they believe it's the right thing to do, but twist that to a vampire bent. Like that is a very dark individual. Someone like I know what you're thinking. How are they a dark individual if they're like enforcing the traditions where no one else will? It's like, well, think about it. Princes enforce the traditions, but they're not always, you know, nice looking out for everyone's best interest. But a road traveling coterie of vampires that viciously enforce every tradition, making sure you don't break the masquerade, even if a feeding goes bad, and who hasn't been there, or making sure you're not making these bastard children because you can't get okayed for it in the city and then leaving them when they're not accepted in the city. Right.
I could see it.
Yeah.
No, you're already painting pictures for me, man. I already started going Lankea route of like these godless heathens need a little bit of longness in their life.
That too. Right? I didn't even think about that. Someone who has decided to brave the wastes in between cities to bring the light of Longinus or the darkness of Longinus, I guess.
Yeah, you're completely right. And I could also see this from a Carthian perspective, too, because whereas they might buck the status quo and or try to adopt, you know, a specific type of human way of government, it doesn't mean that they're also exempt from the tradition. They also still do hold the traditions in line. And if it ends up being that particular domain is just not acting upright, it's time to go in there and make things happen, right? It's time to go ahead and uphold them. Not only for other cities, though, but for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they know what the consequences would be otherwise. The second type of folks that would probably be taking a look at this, actually, would be they do it simply for purposes of survival. And I think this one's probably the easiest one to kind of just, it's not so much gloss over as it is, it's a duh situation, right? We've proven to you before that the reason why you follow traditions is because everyone within the city needs to go ahead and survive. You're in a coterie. Now, instead of thinking of 20, 30 vampires, you're thinking about, you know, your coterie of 5, 6, 7, whatever the case is. In order for us to survive, follow the traditions. They ain't going to hurt you, right? Or at least that's what you think.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, we have those, no matter, you can't escape them, folks. You always have your rabble rousers. You always have your Anunnaki some way. And you always want to have vampires who simply defy the traditions just because. Damn the man in the city. Damn the man on the road. I'm going to do what I want.
Yeah, these are right? The people that they might live by the phrase "don't shit where you eat," but they have no problem shitting where other people live. Right? These are the people, the serial masquerade breakers. That maybe they're those same couch surfers you were talking about before. Right? The same Carthians that are going around trying to educate people, but it's obvious they parrot the words, but didn't take the meanings to heart because they also killed 5 people at the club down the street, and now they're like hop in town, so we have to deal with that, and we only just selected the prefect like 3 hours ago.
That's his issue, not ours. That's what we're taking away here. It's a whole lot of them. It's not a whole lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
But then you know, it's funny because it segues into our next section where we're talking about like, well, what about those folks that do end up having to run, right? What do you find in terms of shelter? And I think this section was actually pretty quartery, and I'll tell you why, folks. When you come into it, there's always a level of desperation. And until that fight or flight actually hits you, it's like going to my equating it would be kind of like walking into a CD store. You knew you were going to pick up that album that you had in your head. It was like that Megadeth thing was about to drop, but then you see a wall full of possibilities. And so you never really think about it because now your focus is gone. But when you start to razor in on it, where do you hide when you're a nomad? What options are made available to you? The first thing we could think of, probably, all right, we'll sunproof the trunk of my vehicle. That might be able to work. I don't know. Put myself in the black plastic bag. Does that work? No, maybe.
What about sleeping bags? Sleeping bags are lightproof, right? Right?
Right. That should work. If not, a coffin, right? We'll get ourselves a hearse and that'll work. And those are like the first novel things that we think about, right? The first things that novice level, that's what we have. But you take a look at a couple of them, and like the ones that drew my attention were definitely like parking garages.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's awesome because you think about those multi-level parking garages that exist next to like a office building. And then at night, all you have to do is just kind of drive up to where you need to. And there's always going to be a staff only room that's usually saved for maintenance. And no one's really going to be hiding in the maintenance room anyway to begin with. Right. So what a perfect spot to hide, at least for the evening. Don't have to worry about it. Most people wouldn't even think to look at you there. There aren't any mortals around. So it's not like you have to worry about the food source coming either. I thought that was really cool. Houses for sale is another.
Mm-hmm.
If it's open house for any kindred that needs to lay their head down for one night, and woe unto them who decide to break in and or have a a late night visit.
Who would have thought vampires would be a proponent for squatters' rights? But there was another one that actually stuck out to me because it was like, I never thought of this. Shopping malls. Shopping malls, DJ. Would you have ever in your life thought a shopping mall would be a great haven for a coterie of vampires?
Initially, no. And the only thing that's running through my head as I keep thinking about Dawn of the Dead and
right?
all of them being inside a shopping mall, and I was like, I don't want to get stuck in there. However, hit me up with like, what is so unique about shopping malls and what you could do with them as a member of a coterie on the run?
Yeah, so at first, like I first read that, I was like, this is dumb. This isn't going to make any sense, but I'll give you a shot, authors of this book. And they were like, all right, so it's not actually that hard. You can sneak into it. Like, just follow the cleaning crew. Usually they come in early morning, not hard to spot either. Follow them in. And then you go, I don't know if you know this, because it never occurred to me. Do shopping malls have basements?
Depends where you are.
Yeah.
Some do.
Yeah. So go down to the basement, right? Not hard to find because it's behind like a staff only door. Granted, if you followed in a cleaning crew, usually they're going to take you to like the staff service corridors that are there. Go down to a lower level. Start, find a place that is, used for storage, right? Usually you can tell by the amount of dust everywhere, but follow it through until you find a room where you can like close it, maybe lock it. Or if you hit the jackpot, you found a place that's like full of their lost and found, you know, the things that are too cheap to really find the owners for, but too expensive to just toss, and just like bury yourself in it, right? Or take whatever example you want. Maybe it's like a storage closet you jam from the inside or something. But like it never occurred to me like basement of a shopping mall working.
No, and that is a good one, because now that you mention it, not in this lifetime, probably when I was much younger and roaming around many shopping malls, I have like taken back exits from them, and they're pretty wide. There's a lot of hiding room that you could have. It also kind of reminds me of another spot where you think about that creep show, the first one where they had that the monster that was inside of a crate that had just like sat underneath like this board for a long time and no one found it. And then afterwards it was the Antarctic monkey. It just kind of like came out. Folks, once again, you can't see us as we're trying to pop out of our chest here.
You did, but like the like pop goes the weasel, like you just jumped.
I mean, hey, if you were Kindred, you'd be doing the same thing too.
Jumping out of boxes? Is that what? Yeah. Okay.
I mean,
I need to play more of your games.
If any of you folks have ever had this experience and or plan on doing it, please, by all means, hit us up with any information. We'd be more than happy to read about it, and then we could compare notes and teach Brendan a thing or two. However, you know, we get to, you know, all jokes aside, though, ultimately, what is the life of a nomad kind of amount to? You know, to say the least, it's a sad life to a certain degree, because there's a certain amount of freedom that's granted to you because you chose it, much in the same way you chose to stay in the city for purposes of being around others, that you know you are going to be a patsy for pretty much anyone that you walk into. You are an opportunity for everyone else in that city to make use of, you know, an expendable asset, most definitely. A reason, a scapegoat as to why things are not working out in the city, especially after your first two nights, and you haven't even done anything. But the members, those kindred of that domain, were just waiting for any other reason to kind of air out dirty laundry and blame it on someone outside of themselves and have plausible cause. That's the life that you're kind of taking a look at there, you know, and that kind of draws your attention. But what it does do is it creates great story, because do you fight back against those kindred that are within the city? Do you have the ability to? Do you even want to? Right. At that point, it's just like, oh, well, we're never going to get a hot meal. Chances are they probably left the food out to begin with. It's probably going to be cold. It is what it is. We've been through one too many domains where we've seen it happen. Don't worry, it doesn't faze us. This is a normal thing. However, and then you start a conversation that way. Bren, do you have any insight as to like what a nomad life for you would kind of amount to from this perspective?
Yeah. In my mind, there's a quote from like Rogue One that honestly pops to mind. It's like just taking every chance as it comes up. And once you've succeeded, you just take the next one and you just keep going. That in my mind is the life of a nomad. Because like it said in the beginning, right, it is to be a nomad is to take your freedom and have your self-reliance. But what that means is you can't even rely on other people. I would say even if you're part of a covenant and you go to another city where that covenant is in control, it does not mean that they are your friends or that they're even willing to help you. That they might be more willing to do it, right? Especially if you're like one of those traveling missionary members of the Lankea, but even then not necessarily. because exactly the reason you said you are an outsider. You are not part of that domain. And because of that, you are always an other, quote unquote, someone who is ripe to be a scapegoat, or maybe not. Maybe they just don't like people that aren't, that weren't embraced by them.
And that brings up a good thing, you know, a good kind of example to our audience here who isn't familiar, or once again needs to kind of take a look at what strikes Requiem a little bit differently as well. Normally, when you're taking a look from Masquerade, you're like either Camarilla or Sabbat or Anarch, right? Well, who cares about the Anarchs? But we know who the enemy is, essentially. It comes down to essentially, we know who the enemy is. But let's take a look at it from the perspective of, you know, a member of the Lankea. And sure, he hates, or they hate, the members of the Crone, or they can't stand them, or they find them a nuisance, but that's their battle with them. Mm-hmm. And you're a member of the Lankea also coming into their diocese right now. But you're not them. And because of the fact that every domain operates differently and they interpret covenant laws or the way that they operate as a covenant within each domain separately, it doesn't guarantee you anything. And they would rather take that crone side who they've been battling over because you'll get in the way of it and or disrupt what they have. Mm-hmm. And that just shows you the true level of pettiness that you can find.
The true level of pettiness. I just have to say, I'm glad you threw out that idea because I have always loved those stories of like two old enemies that like they've almost defined their very existence by their opposition to the other. But some outsider comes in and tries to like tip the balance or do something, and they both turn at the same time to attack the outsider. And then once that's resolved, they just go back to fighting each other again. Like, I've always loved that dynamic, and that is one that would bite you in the ass if you are a nomad coming into that situation.
No, you're right. You're right. It's like, who this? Nah, not here. Get out of here. This ain't for you. But we could see it, folks, because once again, this all goes back to the party, right? Where these Carthian champions had already broken into. This ain't the party for them. The hosts are having it out right now. You know,
it all comes back to the party. I know what our snippet is for this episode.
There we go. But for all you Cane Bros out there, we actually do have mechanics that are actually in this book as well. There's a fair amount of blood sorcery rituals that are done, both from the perspective of Theban sorcery as well as Kruak. Mm-hmm. But we also do have a couple of devotions that are also created that would make your, you know, kindred last on the road a little bit longer. I'll pick one off the bat. The one that I thought was kind of interesting was there is this Kruak ritual known as Balancing of the Four Humors. Mm-hmm. And what it does in the TLDR point of view is that it controls your vitae so that it deals with the extremes of being out. What if you were one of those vampires out in 30 days a night? You know, it's kind of hard that a trench coat ain't going to keep you there. It's too cold. You got to go ahead and bundle up. There's a chance that you might have to suffer that frostbite. But with this particular ritual and knowing exactly what you're walking into, the environment that you might be going to expose yourself to, this is a survival tool. Mm-hmm. Like there isn't any way around it. A lot of, if not all of these mechanics are provided both in terms of rituals as well as devotions is all for the survival of your kindred. They're practical applications. And Brendan, I believe you had one that called to mind.
Yeah, I did. The other one is called a Scent of the Beast, and a little bit different from what you just said. This is one of the few outliers. This devotion is not to make you survive, help you survive on the road. This is to help you track someone down to ensure they don't survive on the road. So to kind of harken back to what we said earlier about how every single covenant has their spies and assassins, this is the assassin devotion. Sent to the Beast allows, a kindred to literally sniff the psychic resonance of a vampire and track them to where they were going. So even if you couldn't actually find them by other means, you can literally sniff out their beast. And that is awesome. That's dope. That's terrifying too. Cause imagine, I want you to imagine you and me, DJ, we're that coterie on the lamb, right? We were supposed to protect that Invictus Elder, but we were too busy, you know, couch surfing with the Carthians to do it, and now the Invictus are sending their hitter after us, and like we're getting out of there as soon as we can. We're swapping cars. We even took a boat at some point, and then we show up to the next city, and the very next night he's there on our trails. Like, how do we get rid of this guy? It's almost like the It Follows devotion. If you ever saw that movie,
You're right. And chances are it's either that or one of us was wearing Axe and the scent was just too unmistakable from us broing out at that party that he knew enough to follow us.
Axe man.
Well, that, but yeah, joking aside, it is pretty potent. It's a very, very good devotion and it kind of plays and sings to how malleable these disciplines are, especially mm-hmm. in Requiem and how they play out, right? Things that work out to only enhance that feeling. You know, this kind of winds us down a little bit too. They do have a section, you know, even though they might not have that particular, you know, laid out template. They do have notable characters in here, a lot of them, actually, and they're very well written from our perspectives. We each kind of chose one. I'll choose my first to kind of go ahead. It's he falls under the addict, right? His name is Mike Jones. He's a Ventru who's very sickly looking. And as he starts moving from domain to domain, he only takes one type of payment for the most part. Or he's only craving one thing, and that's Vitae, Vampire Vitae. You know, other Ventru, of course, under the auspice of hospitality, will go ahead and accept him, and they'll try messing around with him. He can't be that strong, right? He doesn't seem like he belongs to anything, considering he has no domain of his own. Yeah, they'll feed him blood once, twice, maybe three times on separate nights, thinking that something's going to work in their favor. Unfortunately for them, just as shit is about to hit the fan, that's when Mike Jones leaves. And what makes him special is that Mike Jones already has a maniculum to someone. That's his sire. He out there in Georgia somewhere sleeping. He's afraid he's going to wake up. But in the meantime, doesn't mean he can't be a scoundrel and doesn't mean he can't take advantage of the fact that every domain reacts a little bit differently and that he has to make sure no one else tells his tale. Otherwise, he's in the deep one. Right. But I found that character, especially for a Ventru and one as twirly mustache as it comes, does exist out there in the world. Brent, what was yours?
Mine is a personal favorite. I think this is the first time I'll bring up this character, but I assure you it won't be the last. And that is the Unholy, which is probably the most badass epitaph I've ever seen attributed to any character. But the Unholy is a and those of you who haven't heard of this particular character, she is a she's a particularly well-known gangrel. She's actually considered a legend, a literal legend amongst kindreds. And it's that wherever she goes, chaos follows. This is a walking hurricane and a nightmare for any prince, whether that's Invictus, Carthian, even Circle of the Crone. Anyone who runs a domain, you want to know where she is just so you can prepare. Just like that hurricane, if you need to like batten down the hatches because she's heading your way, this is the person you have to watch out for. But she is always... Her history is always, I'm not even going to say vague. It's just there's multiple. You don't know where she came from. Everyone has a different story of where she was, and people always have different stories about what she did when she came to her domain. However, a couple of things are usually consistent. She comes in and she introduces herself to whoever is in charge, right? Following those edicts of, you know, being polite when you show up to someone's house. And she's perfectly fine for 2 weeks. For 2 weeks, she minds her manners, her P's and Q's, and as soon as that second week is up, something flies off the handle. She does either it's just bedlam in the city, or she does something that causes her to be brought before the prince or whoever is in charge, where they render their verdict. And that court session becomes a bloodbath. There's my second-ed fans out there will note that there is a very particularly dangerous... I think it's a merit. Yeah, it's a merit named after her called Claws of the Unholy. For all my Kane bros out there, that is how you get a gangrel to deal ag. And it is it's named after her for a reason.
I think that one of the things that definitely mentions, especially in her write up, is she has such low humanity.
Oh, yes.
But the write up specifically mentions she willingly, like, her humanity is so low. You wonder how she hasn't dropped into being like a white at this point. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because she needs humanity to understand her prey. So the only reasons that she's keeping any vestiges of what it's like to remain civil and or shards of like her memory are simply because she needs it in order to mimic her prey and better understand them in order for her to strike and do what she's about to do. I thought that was a badass description as it was.
I've got a question for you, though, DJ, and I'm glad you brought that up. Do you believe her prey are people, or do you believe her prey are kindred?
You know, that's a really good question. I'm going to have to go with kindred, but that's also under the assumption that they have to act humane enough.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I would mortals are mortals, but Lord only knows what she's up to. However, it's funny that you should mention that, because if she's trying to mimic her prey, what better than to mimic those that are mimicking others?
That's true.
So it's the ultimate LOL Inception game. I got you.
Also, but also, just so you know, I knew the answer to that. That's because I cheated and looked at her stats. Yes, you're right. She has to. But anyway, caution aside.
But but folks, that was, you know, that is our review of Nomads. Brendan, what would you say about this book? If you had to give it out there, what's your thoughts on it?
My thoughts are, if you are running any chronicle where it's not contained to a single city, but perhaps to a region like the Yucatan Peninsula, this is a really good book. It's great, because going through this, like, I always knew, like, vampires traveling between cities was dangerous, right? But like, why? And people will say, you know, there are werewolves out there that hate you, right? Do werewolves hate you in this game? Do they kill you on sight? We've not gotten there yet, but I think we're going to at some point. But what dangers would you see on the road? And this one did open my eyes to some I hadn't even thought about. So for if you were running a chronicle like that, or if you're wanting to understand how covenants might work with each other, right? Like communicate with each other, or what interactions they would have from city to city. This is a good book for that.
Agreed. Agreed. And I would layer on to that, because I think the biggest takeaway for me, especially, you know, once again, folks, as we're reviewing, this is also with 2020 hindsight views. And as some of these, like, healthy amount of these books were just written very well, we just didn't understand it at the time. And for me, I also took away from that, I have more, you know, reading it the second time around, it's the archetypes of what a covenant would do, especially on the road, is what draws my attention the most. Yeah, there are the templates in there that we found, you know, interesting, the basic ones, spies, assassins, etc., courtiers. But it also gives you the ability to kind of expand upon it. Why would you be on the road? All right. These Invictus are trying to deliver a message. The story seeds alone that could come from it, there's a lot of value in that. And of course, there are mechanics on the back for, once again, our game bros. But for me, it's a definite pickup there. It's a very easy read. So it doesn't seem like you're crunching there. There's enough story to keep you entertained about why. You could let your imagination run wild. But that's our verdict there. So for those of you folks who are interested, by all means, feel free to go ahead and pick up the book, discuss with us. And I think that's all for now. Folks, we thank you for listening. We really appreciate it. I think next week, what's our next book that we're covering there, Bren?
We are covering Bloodlines the Hidden.
Yep.
Bloodlines
now the we're Hidden. Getting to some interesting stuff, right? We were talking about clans before. There only being five, but what are the deviations in the blood? And how do you make them manifest? And considering they're the hidden, well, we won't spoil it here. We'll say that for our next podcast. But once again, folks, we thank you for your time. Brent, any words to our audience?
It always comes back to the party, folks. I'll see you there.
See you there. Take it easy, folks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to our 25 years of Vampire the Masquerade podcast. If you liked what you heard, please reach out and let us know on Twitter at 25 years of VTM, at our email, info@25yearsvtm.com, on Facebook at www.facebook.com/25yearsvtm, or on our website, www.25yearsvtm.com. If you would like to support us, we can be found at patreon.com/25yearsofvampirethemasquerade.